So good morning, dear Thai, dear Sangha. happy to report to you that I can hear clearly out of both ears now. Thanks to Suzanne and Sarah's equine syringe. I thought this is a good example of interbeing. You know? Works for a horse, it works for me. A very big, like that big of earwax, a clump came out of my ear. Suzanne said, "You have a very productive ear." That's sad. So I first want to just express my gratitude for the opportunity to share with you today. I was getting so excited yesterday preparing for the talk and realized what a gift it is to be able to have an occasion to share what's really important for me. And somehow in preparing to share, I get in touch more with what's important to me. It's like if I wouldn't have the chance to share, I might not have touched all these different things. I think it's like that for our friends who shared last night too. I found each person sharing so enriching and so meaningful. I'm really grateful for everyone last night. So today I want to speak about the four nutriments. I guess I have a thing about the number four. And one I'm going to begin with is the food of volition. What is our intention for our life? And as I was looking into what I wanted to share today, I was so grateful because it was really putting me in touch with my volition. What is my real desire for what I want to do with my life? But I'll begin first sharing a story. This is a story from a Benedictine monk named Father Theophane. He's since passed away, but he wrote a very kind of whimsical but very deep book with lovely drawings called The Magic Monastery. The Magic Monastery. he also did a lot of Zen practice. And I met him once. I went to his monastery in Colorado where they were doing a Japanese session in the monastery. So this is a story he wrote called What Am I Leaving Out? I knew there were many interesting sights, but I didn't want any more of the little answers. I wanted the big answer. So I asked the guest master to show me directly to the house of God. I sat myself down, quite willing to wait for the big answer. I remained silent all day, far into the night. I looked him in the eye. I guess he was looking me in the eye. Late at night, I seemed to hear a voice. What are you leaving out? I looked around. I heard it again. What are you leaving out? Was it my imagination? Soon it was all around me, whispering, roaring. What are you leaving out? What are you leaving out? Was I cracking up? I managed to get to my feet and head for the door. I wanted the comfort of a human face or a human voice. Nearby was the corridor where some of the monks live. I knocked on one cell. What do you want? Came a sleepy voice. What am I leaving out? Me, he answered. I went to the next door. What do you want? What am I leaving out? Me. A third cell, a fourth, all the same. I thought, they're all stuck on themselves. I left the building in disgust. Just then, the sun was coming up. I had never spoken to the sun before, but I heard myself pleading, what am I leaving out? The sun, too, answered, me. That finished me. I threw myself on the ground, and the earth said, me too. So, this retreat is looking into interbeing. This is a story about how our enlightenment has to include everything. All the things that we're leaving out. That we think are not us. I also want to share with you something that G.U. Kennett, she was a Dharma teacher who started Shasta Abbey in Northern California. She was an English woman who went to be trained in Japan. And she wrote, her book of memoirs is called Wild White Goose. So this is her reflection on what it means to not kill. If we kill something deliberately, there's a bit of ourselves that we're cutting off. And there's something even more than that. We're saying that something hasn't got the right to live. In other words, that something hasn't got the right to be Buddha. There's something that we're not accepting. Something we're saying just can't be Buddha. That's the precept everyone breaks when they say, this is pure and that's impure. It means that if I say that Hitler is difficult to see as a Buddha, I'm trying to kill Buddha. If I say something is unclean, I'm killing the Buddha nature within that thing itself. Every time we look at somebody and say, well, I can see the Buddha nature in so-and-so, but I can't see it in him over there, we're literally killing the Buddha, and it's our own delusions that kill the Buddha. That's why we don't know that we ourselves are Buddha. That is why we are not enlightened. Because we cannot recognize the Buddha in all things, we constantly kill the Buddha. We can know, we can feel instinctively that the Buddha is everywhere, but we have not understood this, that our bones, flesh, blood, marrow, yes, and our sexual side as well, and all the mud and the things we hate, and all the torture sides of ourselves and all the evil, all is the aspect of the Buddha mind. We have to learn to accept it and work through it and bring compassion to bear on those who only exhibit one aspect, and even love them whilst we restrain them, because only by so doing can we teach them better things. So every one of us is a murderer every day of the week, every time we discriminate. That is the meaning of do not kill. It is not just don't go out and slaughter an animal for food. It is don't discriminate against other people. Don't set yourself up. Don't say, I know who's a true teacher and I know who isn't. Because instantly we are killing. That is why homage to the Buddha, homage to the Dharma, homage to the Sangha are the only real precepts. And anybody who takes the refuges completely has taken the precepts. It means that I believe there is within me something greater, something far more wonderful than I have yet been able to show to the world. It means that I know that within me is something intrinsically good, and that I can be worthy of it by being better than I am. That there is a teaching which can help me. And there are teachers who have realized their true nature who can give me guidance. So, I want to look at the four nutriments, the four kinds of food that the Buddha talked about in light of what can help us to really see our connection with all these things that are part of us. When the Buddha gave this teaching, he talked about the first food being edible food, so the food we eat with our teeth and tongue. And then the second food as the food of sense impressions, what we take in through our eyes as images, our ears as sounds, smells, tastes. And the third, he spoke about volition, the food of what motivates us, what wakes us up, gets us out of bed in the morning because we want to get something done, because we have a vision or a dream that we want to realize. And the fourth is the food of consciousness, the thoughts, the memories, all the seeds that are stored in our consciousness that we feed on. And there's individual consciousness, our own personal history and personality and way of seeing, and there's the collective consciousness. But instead of starting with the first, I'll start with the third of volition. So, I have recently asked a friend for advice on whether I should include a trip to South Africa on my year sabbatical. I was just feeling like it was getting too full. And her reply was really helpful. She just went right to volition. She said, well, what's most important to you in your life? You know, life is short. Like, will this trip be in line with what's most important to you? Is it going to support you? And I think it's a really good litmus test to just look at any decision we have to make in light of what is our deepest desire for our life. And to really take time to figure that out. To not let ourselves become so busy that we don't spend time asking that question. You know, am I living in the way I want to be living? Because it really is a source of energy. You know, all these four nutriments, they're all foods. They are what give birth to what comes to be in our life. You know, we are what we eat. So we are all these things that drive us. And if what we are experiencing in our life now isn't what we want, we just have to look at what has fed it. What food has created it? So this is in the sutras. If we can look and see the source of food, of what has come to be, we can be liberated from it. Whether it's depression or disharmony, conflict, we need to understand how it's arisen, what food we've fed it. So this third kind of food is really an important source of energy for each of us. And this kind of food can give someone the courage and the energy to be a suicide bomber and sacrifice their life for that volition of revenge or hatred. And this same energy of volition can give us the energy to lead a nation out of colonialism, like Gandhi in India. And he put everything else aside. And that was his goal, to live simply and to put all of his energy into freeing his country nonviolently. So Thay says we need to use our life to look into what is of our ultimate concern. You know? And not only focus our life on material and emotional comforts. And I think the volition that we're being fed in our society, our consumer society, is use your energy to get material and emotional comforts. That's all you need. And that is the most important thing. But we wouldn't be here if we thought that was all there was. I watched a documentary about Ayurvedic healing in India and was impressed to learn that at least in the traditional practice, I don't know how it is now in India, but you weren't allowed to charge for your services as an Ayurvedic doctor. You know, your patients could offer you whatever they had, but you weren't allowed to require, you know, payment. And I also read a beautiful book called The Wind Is My Mother by a Native American shaman. His name is Bearheart. And he talks about also, you cannot use the medicine, the sacred power that you have for yourself, because then it's corrupt. So any prayers, any special potions or whatever that you've learned, you can only use them to help other people. And once you use it for yourself, you don't have that power anymore. So these are two kind of examples of volition. You know, like, why are we doing something? And I think when our volition is focused in a wholesome direction, we receive a lot of energy to continue to do it. And when it's focused on the ultimate concern, it keeps us in our integrity. It keeps us from betraying ourselves, betraying others. And if our volition for our life, if it doesn't take into account our interbeing with all other things, then I think it's safe to say it's going to be harmful to ourselves and to others. So in this teaching that the Buddha gave about the four nutriments, he used an example for each nutriment. And for the food of volition, he described a man in a village, and in this village is a huge pit with burning coals. And the man knows he needs to leave that village because he doesn't want to get thrown into that pit or fall into it and die. And the Buddha said that pit is, you know, our volition that takes us to greed and hatred, ignorance. It's the unwholesome ways in which we manifest our volition. I think this image of burning coals is very poetic too, because for me I see that it's what's brought us to climate change, you know, these unwholesome volitions. Or this is, I'm going to share a bunch with from you to you all from this article in the Sun magazine with Catherine. Catherine Dean Moore. Anyway, she talks about it as climate chaos. And I've also heard someone say the new term is now global impact, not global warming, but global impact. So people really touched that this is something that impacts all of us, because in some places it gets colder with global warming. So people are like, oh, there's no global warming. So we use the term global impact. Anyway, I think this pit that we need to move away from is also what we're doing to the planet. So what is fed this is this this wish to always accumulate more, to attain more and consume more. This definition of happiness as material success or external kind of well-being. And it keeps us too busy. Keeping up with these outer standards in order to really respond to and be in touch with what's really happening, what's really needed. So we are told by our society dominated by corporations that our job is to be consumers, and fashioned into a homo economicus, our one purpose in life is to consume. And we also turn to that consumption as a kind of escape. So I'll just read to you from this interview with Kathleen Moore. So she is saying how oil companies, petrochemical companies, are very happy that we have a hard time facing the reality of global warming or of global chaos, climate chaos. She's saying, if I were an oil company CEO, I would take heart in this. I would design strategies that build on that aversion to what is unpleasant or horrifying or sad. If you give people a chance to turn away, they will. If you give them a distraction, they will take it. Let's face it, our culture is hooked on cheap oil and consumer goods, and we exhibit all the self-destructive behaviors of addicts. We devote our days to the pursuit of the next hit. We have developed enabling behaviors to allow our addictions to go unchallenged, to deny that they do any harm. I think the addiction to consumer goods is a response to the loss of community. Self-sufficiency, meaningful work, neighborly love, and hope. When these things are taken from us, we look for the cheap fix, which is turning out to be very expensive indeed. So it's so connected how when we don't feel we have a direction, a meaningful purpose for our life, that we take refuge in consumption, in what doesn't really fill our needs, and that destroys the planet in the process. That destroys a future for the next generations. So there are over 1 million suicides per year, and that's twice as many deaths as all people killed in armed conflicts worldwide. And suicide is the leading cause of death for people 35 and under. There's a 400% increase in antidepressants. I don't know in what time period, but There's also a tenfold increase in depression in the last decades. So I had a chance to go to a workshop with Joanna Macy, a wonderful practitioner and deep ecologist. I did a retreat for artists at Findhorn in June, and she was there, and we snuck in. We got to be with her, and she was saying that the larger body that we're a part of, you know, this collective consciousness, our larger society, it's in trauma. You know, and so are we. There's a line in, I think it's the Avatamsaka Sutra, but it might be the Lotus Sutra, maybe Eileen remembers better. The line is, because the world is sick, I am sick. So Joanna Macy was saying, this trauma that we're all experiencing, it gets pathologized. Capitalism makes us think it's some individual problem, something from our early childhood, rather than the truth that this situation is just untenable. It's just not sustainable what we're doing. And we're all suffering from it. And she spoke about the importance of gratitude in this work of healing. That it's particularly relevant when we're surrounded by what we don't like. That it's not dependent on external conditions. Gratitude. That should sound familiar. Because there's a sentence in the second mindfulness training. Happiness is not dependent on external conditions. So we can practice gratitude at any time. She says the most significant aspect of gratitude is that it's politically subversive. Late capitalism instills in us inadequacy, self-loathing, neediness. We're meant to consume. We believe we must have certain things to be socially acceptable. So gratitude is a revolutionary act. To just not buy into this, what we're fed, this nutriment of us not being okay the way we are. She said it's like a worm in an apple, this insinuation of personal insufficiency. And Audre Lorde says something along the same lines of gratitude being revolutionary. She says, caring for myself is not self-indulgence. It is self-preservation, and that is an act of political warfare. So this self-preservation, this preservation of our future, of our children, it has so much to do with how we consume, what food we're taking in. All the four kinds of food that we're putting into our individual and our collective body and mind. So, in this interview, Kathleen Moore also talks about the need for action. So I'll read to you about this. The interviewer, Demacher, says, many of us are waiting until our lives feel less busy before we jump into activism. Hmm. She says, yes, we are busy. Probably too busy to avert a planetary disaster that will have the effect of an asteroid impact, killing off species, altering the climate, acidifying the oceans. Why are we so busy? Those who would prefer we not think about climate change and other injustices would like very much for us to stay busy. If we have to work two jobs to make a living, we're not going to be out in the streets protesting. If we are preoccupied with other parts of our lives, our attention is drawn away from the practices that are destroying the foundation of those lives. I used to think it was enough for all of us to simply live our lives imaginatively and constructively. I don't think that anymore. I think we have to find the time to be politically active. I don't want to cut anybody any slack on that. Are we going to let it all slip away? All those billions of years it took to evolve the song in a frog's throat or the stripe in a lily? Because we're too busy? The ransacking of the world is making the top 1% of the population very, very rich. As the writer Daniel Quinn points out, the rich are like people who live in a fancy penthouse at the top of a 100-story building. And every day they send workers down to take some bricks out of the foundation to increase the size of the penthouse. The building has lots of bricks, so this seems harmless enough. But there will come a time when they will have introduced so many holes in the foundation of the building that it will collapse, and their position at the top of the tower will not save them. So here's a suggestion for how she sees people becoming politically active. She says, we haven't really tried nonviolent methods yet. We haven't tried massive protests and civil disobedience. We haven't tried boycotts. We haven't harnessed the power of the global religions. Somewhere near half of us don't even vote. Here and there, sure, we've tried nonviolence, but not on the scale we need. Let's give it a go. Oren Lyons, faith keeper of the Turtle Clan of the Onondaga Nation, suggests that we need a global council of elders, people like Jimmy Carter and Nelson Mandela and Sheila Watt Cloutier. And Thich Nhat Hanh. They could get together and choose one company to be the target of a global boycott. Every environmental organization, every organization for social change, every church that honors God's creation could call on its members to join the boycott. How many points would the targeted company's stock have to drop before it entered into negotiations and transformed itself? Then the Council of Elders could choose the next company and the next. So after 9/11, Tai did make a suggestion that we should start a Council of Elders to begin sessions of deep listening to hear the suffering in the country and the suffering of those in the Middle East, like the Truth and Reconciliation Committee in South Africa. So I think it's a good idea to look at this as a sangha, you know. I know in our community in Germany, I asked the Sangha not to buy gas from Shell or ExxonMobil. And at least while I was there, I don't know now, but we we agreed not to do that. And a few years ago, a brother introduced me to a website and a book called The Better World Shopper. It lists companies across all sectors based on 5 criteria: human rights, the environment, animal protection, community involvement, so how it treats workers and the surrounding communities, and social justice. And it has a list of, you know, like the 20 worst companies, the 20 best companies. It ranks, you know, in different colors, say airlines. What are the best airlines in these 5 areas? What are the worst? And, well, I'm going to read them to you, actually. I just feel like... I'm going to do the worst first and then the best. Okay, so number 1 is ExxonMobil, Kraft, Walmart, Chevron, Texaco, General Electric, General Motors, Nestle, Pfizer, Citibank, AIG, Microsoft, Archer Daniels Midland, Verizon, Procter & Gamble, Ford, Dillard's, Vanity Fair, United Airlines, Sears, and Bank of America. And by the way, this I think is not the most updated list. I think the website, I don't know how updated it is, because this looks like the list I saw many years ago, so it's probably changed since then. But so the best 20 companies: 7th Generation, Method, Organic Valley, Clif Bar, Aveda, Toms of Maine, which I just learned was bought out by Procter & Gamble, which is one of them. Isn't it? It's on here, right? No. Did I read it? Yes. Mm-hmm. So we have to think about that one. Dr. Bronner's, King Arthur Flour, Earthbound Farm, Dansko Footwear, Patagonia, Working Assets, that's a phone company, a cell phone, Credo. New Belgium Brewing, Nancy's Dairy and Soy, Endangered Species Chocolate, Honest Tea, Earth Friendly, Annie's Naturals, Eden Foods, and Ben and Jerry's, which was also, oh gosh, let's see. That could be where we would start our activism. So, yeah, I think we can think about what ways we might address what's deep in our hearts, in our sanghas. I learned recently there's something called OneEarthSangha.org. It's a Dharma teacher's statement on climate change. And I think 500 Dharma teachers around the world have signed it, many in our tradition. And there's also a place for Dharma practitioners to sign it on the website. So if you're interested in reading it and signing it, it's just called OneEarthSangha.org. But so these companies, that's a practice of the 4 nutriments. Because if we buy from the companies we don't believe in, we're feeding that. We're feeding ourselves something harmful, and we're feeding something harmful in society. and the companies we do believe in, you know, feeding them, that's a political act. You know, feeding ourselves from them. So it's like, was it Dave? Sorry. Yeah, what you said about last night, about, you know, turning off that film of Jim Carrey that was, you know, racist. You know, that's like, no, I'm not going to eat that food anymore. I'm not going to support that. So that's volition. And there's also edible food. How we are consuming edible food, it is really, it's lethal. You know, how we take in edible food. This, you know, climate change is affecting poorer countries the worst, you know, with drought and floods and, you know, people who haven't contributed much to pollution at all are paying the price. So a Dharma teacher, Havin Thaw, was he's now the program director of the Gross National Happiness Center in Bhutan, but he was in the International Red Cross before he took that position in Bhutan, and he told a story. He came to Germany this summer to do a week-long wake-up retreat on the economics of happiness. It was open to all ages, but many young people came. And he was sharing about being at a feeding center in Darfur. There's a civil war in the Sudan, and it's a war over water. And there's, you know, I don't know how many, if it's thousands or millions, but, you know, refugees just displaced. And they have a feeding center because mothers are too malnourished to breastfeed their children. So he was telling the story of this mother who brought her starving child in to be fed, and when she brought the child back some months later, still very underweight, he asked, why hadn't the child gained more weight? And the mother said, well, I have four other children, so the food I'm given for this child, I share with all the children. And I can't let one child go hungry and just feed this child, so that's why that child hadn't gained enough weight. So so they decided to, you know, make sure all the families had enough for all of their children and not just the ones that were the worst off. So he came back again and saw the same woman, and still the child was underweight. And so he inquired what was going on, and the woman explained, because the feeding center is based on a body mass index, that's how you're determined to qualify for food, is if you're under your body mass index. So she wouldn't qualify to get food for her family if her child was at a healthy weight. So she was like starving her child to feed all of her children. So, I mean, this is what's happening, you know. And, you know, he was sharing with us, like, we've created a world that none of us wants. Nobody, if you would go out into the street and ask, you know, would say, yes, I want children to starve. Yes, I want rivers to be polluted and animals to become extinct. Nobody would say that. But we're living like that. What we're doing with our dollars when we buy things and the ways we choose to live, we're condoning that. So this is just Kathleen Moore again on the importance of how we consume and how every act of consumption is political. She says, if the culture forces us to live in ways we don't believe in, then we have to change the culture. Given the urgency of the question, we may need to start with conscientious objection. There are things we must refuse to do, and there are costs for that refusal. Many of us were alive when people said hell no to an unjust war in Vietnam. The question today is, can we say hell no to an unjust economic system? Can we reclaim our humanity from forces that would prefer us to be mindless consumers? Every decision that we make about where we find information, where we get food, what we wear, how we make our living, how we invest our time and our wealth, how we travel or keep ourselves warm and sheltered, is an opportunity for us to express our values, both by saying yes to what we believe in and by saying no to what we don't believe in. I love what Carl Safina, who writes about the ocean, says in Moral Ground. This is her book that she just came out with, Moral Ground. He says, we think we don't want to sacrifice, but sacrifice is exactly what we're doing. We're sacrificing what is big and permanent to prolong what is small, temporary, and harmful. We're sacrificing animals, peace, and children to retain wastefulness. So many of us wake up in the morning and eat a breakfast of food we don't believe in, and then drive a car we don't believe in to a job we don't believe in. We do things that we know are wrong day after day just because that's the way the system is set up, and we think we have no choice. It's soul devouring. Deciding we won't drive to that chain grocery store and buy that imported pineapple is a path of liberation. Deciding to walk to the farmer's market and buy those fresh local peas is like spitting in the eye of the industries that would control us. Every act of refusal is also an act of assent. Every time we say no to consumer culture, we say yes to something more beautiful and sustaining. Life is not something we go through or that happens to us. It is something we create by our decisions. We can drift through our lives, or we can use our time, our money, and our strength to model behaviors we believe in, to say, this is who I am. Like the five mindfulness trainings. She says also, if you own stock in a petrochemical industry, you've got to dump it. If you benefit from a fund that owns stock in a petrochemical industry, a university fund, a retirement fund, you've got to insist they dump it. No excuses, no delays. Food, that is traditionally the first nutriment. The second nutriment is sense impressions, what we take in through our senses. The Buddha, to dramatize this, told a story of a cow that has had skin disease. And when the cow would walk by an old wall or an old tree, all the insects would come out and suck the blood of the cow because it wasn't protected. And so the Buddha says, this is what happens to us if we don't take care in how we consume through our senses. We get consumed. There's a couple I heard about who shared, they came to Germany to our retreat center, and they said they used to read the paper every day, and practicing mindfulness, they realized that every time they read it, they felt depressed. And they decided to read it once a week. You know, I think we don't want to close our eyes before suffering, but we don't want to paralyze ourselves by taking in what's not helpful. So they found that it was a good balance for them to read the paper, to get the Sunday paper, to get enough news and not more than they needed to take in. I know this winter, Thay has asked the monastics to stop eating the food of Facebook for the winter, for the 3-month winter retreat. You know, just to be more aware. What are we taking in? What is our energy going out towards? You know. So, the last of the four nutriments is the food of consciousness. And the story that the Buddha told about consciousness is, he said that there was a thief that was caught and brought to the king. And the king said, stab him 100 times. So the guards, soldiers, they did this, and they came back to the king and said, we've done it, and he's still alive. So the king said, okay, stab him 100 more times. And so the Buddha said, the way we consume the food of consciousness is like we're stabbing ourselves hundreds of times. So it means what I was sharing about in the last talk about appropriate attention. You know, we feed off of things that harm us. You know, memories or a kind of rumination. We put our attention on things that don't bring us to well-being. There's a book by Jill Bolt Taylor. I think it's called My Stroke of Insight. She's a neurobiologist who had a stroke, and it changed her life to just get in touch with the left side of the brain, is the emotional side? The right side, thank you, yeah. So she was a right brain person for a while until those functions came back in her left brain. Anyway, she talks about in that book how the physiological length of an emotion is 90 seconds. Like if you're driving and someone cuts in front of you, you might have just a visceral reaction of irritation or anger, and you know, the natural length of that experience is just 90 seconds. But because of the way we consume the food of consciousness, we might be upset about that for 20 minutes. Or if we have an argument with someone, you know, they just said those words once, but we stab ourselves with them 100 times in just thinking over and over about it. You know, that's not mindful consumption. That's not healthy eating of the nutriment of consciousness. also, you know, we pollute with how we consume goods, but we also pollute with our thinking. I read about a monk in Thailand who protects the forests from logging. But he was encouraging people who would come, you know, don't pollute with your mind, because we can make it worse with how we think. When this Dharma teacher, Havin Thaw, came to the EIB, he was also sharing that it's really important when we see suffering in us, not to blame others. And also when we look at global issues, not to see it as external to us. The first thing we need to transform is our idea of a world out there. Them, the bad guys. We're part of it and we're co-creating it. He said, there's only one world. So we must always come back to ourselves when we suffer or feel anger at things around us. So just in our personal relationships, you know, with those close to us, I've experienced, you know, getting into a negative attachment with someone that I have difficulty with, that they occupy a really huge part of my thinking and my life because I'm so upset at them. And it's like that person is my problem. They're the cause of my suffering. And yeah, just letting go of that way of perceiving. It's very narrow. It's focusing in, letting go, stepping back, seeing the bigger perspective. So that our whole life doesn't revolve around them and our ideas, our resentments around them. It doesn't mean that we don't need to address problems in our relationships, because we definitely do, and there are helpful practices like beginning anew, the peace treaty, that can help us. I guess what I see is that in my experience I really need to keep my perspective and not think that if that problem is gone, everything will be okay. Because my mind always creates more. So it's not from the outside. One time in Germany I was at breakfast and a sister came in late for breakfast and I was irritated because I perceived that she did that a lot. And somehow I just caught myself and I asked myself, you know, would I really be happy if she had come on time? And I realized, no, I would have found something else to be irritated at her for. You know, I knew that. It wouldn't have really made me happy. And I also experienced, you know, the person I felt was just a difficult person, that if they would just leave, everything would be okay. You know, they were at another center for a few months, and I thought, oh, thanks, now we can all be more at ease. And it was the opposite. Things got worse. So I just really saw that the other person is not the problem, at least not more of the problem than I am. So both our happiness and our suffering are born inside of us. And if we take care of it in here, you know, it's a huge contribution to our planet. There's a man who I heard speak at this, when I was at FinTorn, there was a gathering on sustainability and people from eco-villages all over the world and co-housing and intentional living came together to, you know, meet for a few days. And Robert Gilman, who founded the Context Institute in the early 70s, was the first organization to really look at sustainability kind of globally, and it's still going. He gave the opening plenary talk. And he said, there are no environmental problems. There are only environmental symptoms of human problems. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I think coming back to look at how are we consuming the food of consciousness, food of sense impressions, food of volition, food of edible food. Ending our human problems so that we can end environmental problems. Like, I was just at Blue Cliff before coming here, our monastery in New York. And I went in for sitting in the morning and I was realizing I was having this internal grumbling about things I had heard and, you know, reactions I was having to some things. And suddenly I just realized that it wasn't the people that I was grumbling about that were causing my suffering, but it was the way I was looking at them as being a problem. And when I saw that, it was, everything shifted and I was like, well, there's no problem because I don't have a problem with it, so there's no problem, you know. So this is why we practice. This is why we need to practice diligently, to uproot these human problems that cause all the outer problems that we see. The Buddha said it's with our minds that we create the world. So this is something Charlotte Joko Beck said. She said, as long as we don't feel open and loving, our practice is right there waiting for us. And since most of the time we don't feel open and loving, most of the time we should be practicing meticulously. Thank you.